From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. When fire raced through the Mount Carmel compound of the Branch Davidians in April 1993, it sparked an already simmering hatred of the federal government inside Timothy McVeigh. 2 years later, McVeigh killed 168 people when he bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building. While Timothy McVeigh is dead, his partner in crime, Terry Nichols, sits in the Supermax prison in Colorado, but their right-wing ideology continues to spread. Among the books of best-selling author Jeffrey Toobin, the O.J. Simpson trial, the Clinton impeachment, the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump. Well, his new book is Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. In it, he points to McVeigh's legacy as part of what drove many of the January 6th rioters to the Capitol in 2021, hoping to overturn the 2020 election and overthrow the government. Jeffrey Toobin joins me this hour. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Hi, John.
Say, you know, that 2021 attempt at overturning all those results, people make the mistake of thinking that that might be an isolated incident or even just a symptom of what started with the election of Donald Trump. But you're pointing out, no.
No, there's a long history there. And to let you know what specifically prompted me to write Homegrown is, I covered the McVeigh and Nichols trials, which took place in 1997, 2 years after the bombing in Denver, where they were moved. But I the story had been sort of rattling around in my head for a long time. But what really brought it back to me was a few weeks before January 6th, in October of 2020, you'll remember that the FBI arrested a group of people in Michigan who were plotting to kidnap the governor, Gretchen Whitmer. And I started looking into that case, and I saw that many of the people who were arrested were affiliated with the Michigan militia. I remembered that Terry Nichols, the other defendant in the Oklahoma City bombing, was also from Michigan and also affiliated with the Michigan militia. As I look further, I saw that even some of the same people were involved in the 90s and, you know, almost 30 years later. It was then that January 6th happened. And I started to see the ideological associations and the beliefs associations among these various right-wing extremists, which prompted me to go back to the Oklahoma City bombing story and tell that story, but also try to explain why it's so relevant today and why those connections that you talked about are so real.
You know, a lot of people, a lot of historians went to talk to President Biden his first year in office, saying they're worried about democracy in America, that it's under assault. And your book makes that argument that, look, we need to be very careful about what happened and what could happen.
Well, and you know, this is, again, as you said, it is not a new threat, but it's a real one. And it's an enduring one. And one of the points that I emphasize in Homegrown is that McVeigh didn't mobilize the constituency that he thought was out there. You know, as he told his lawyers once, there's an army out there, I just couldn't find it. What McVeigh didn't have was the internet and social media, which is such a valuable organizing tool. And if you look at the right-wing extremist violence that we've seen in recent years, whether it's shooting up the Walmart in El Paso, or the synagogue in Pittsburgh, or the church by Dylann Roof in South Carolina, or the grocery store in Buffalo, it's all encouraged, motivated by what these people found on the internet. So McVeigh's failure to find his followers, that's been remedied, alas, by the existence of the internet and the ability of people with these beliefs to talk to each other and organize together.
You know, so let's go back. So there are two incidents that you hear a lot anytime people are talking about the far right. One of them, obviously, is the bombing of the Murrow Federal Building. The other one is the Ruby Ridge siege and Randy Weaver. This is back in 1992. Again, a few months after that, the Branch Davidians in Waco. I want to start with Randy Weaver, because this is this narrative that we hear from people similar to McVeigh, that these things motivated him to do what he did.
You know, that's right. And the larger theme that connects all these ideas, or not, they're not just ideas, they are incidents, they are events that took place, is this tremendous hostility to the federal government, which is, again, something that is enduring in American history and certainly didn't start in the 1990s. And even further, what motivates the anger is the issue of guns and the fear that the federal government is going to take people's guns away. Randy Weaver was a sort of political iconoclast in Idaho who was under investigation for illegal possession of weapons. The initial investigation of the Branch Davidian compound and David Koresh near where you are in Waco was about illegal possession of weapons. And the investigation was led at the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms. The fundamental objection of these extremists to any sort of regulation of firearms is the background ideology to all of this. And it is certainly, if you, as I do in my book, look at McVeigh's background, the obsession with guns is central to understanding why he did what he did. And I mean, just to elaborate on that point a little, yes, it's true that McVeigh planned the bombing on April 19th, which was the second anniversary of the FBI raid at Waco. And yes, it is true that McVeigh went to Waco during the siege and sold bumper stickers and offered support to Koresh and his followers. But it is not just Waco. There is an equally significant date for McVeigh's mobilization, which is September 13th, 1994, several months earlier, which is when Bill Clinton signed the assault weapons ban. And McVeigh was just as upset and just as outraged by the attempt to regulate assault weapons, which was only a 10-year ban. Assault weapons, as we all now know, are not regulated by the federal government anymore. But the issue of guns and the fear of the federal government's regulation of guns is so central to the story, and it's what ties Oklahoma City, Randy Weaver, Waco, and McVeigh all together.
Yeah, you know, McVeigh grew up in New York, Lockport, New York, if I remember yes. correctly. He saw all these opportunities that his dad had, that his, I guess, his grandfather had. And with industrial decline, a lot of that went away. He's looking for somebody to blame.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you look at McVeigh's life, and this is true to a certain extent of Terry Nichols' life as well, you know, it's a petri dish of all the issues, both personal and political, that made people so angry and still make people so angry. You know, as you pointed out, Lockport is just outside Buffalo. McVeigh's father worked in a GM plant for 30 years. His grandfather worked in the same plant for 30 years. By the time McVeigh came of age in the 1980s, that plant, like so many in the industrial Northeast, was on its way to shrinking dramatically. There were no options to work there, even if McVeigh had been so inclined. So you see industrial decline. He takes a job in Buffalo as a security guard, and at least according to him, you know, he sees Black people in a hostile light, and racism starts to become a big motivating factor. His parents have a rancorous divorce. His mother leaves to Florida with the two daughters, leaving McVeigh behind with the father, creating a kind of Sophie's Choice situation. Mm-hmm. McVeigh never has any success with women. Today, he would probably be called an incel, an involuntary celibate, which is a sort of quasi-political movement reflecting anger at modern American women. In the 90s, he starts listening to Rush Limbaugh, whose anger he absorbs. You know, none of these things in and of themselves explain why McVeigh did what he did. Obviously, millions of people listened to Rush Limbaugh and never became criminals of any kind. But if you look at all of these influences together and combined with McVeigh's unique and uniquely evil character, you see how he became what he became.
There was a Rush Limbaugh. There was a guy named Bill Cooper, if I remember.
Yeah, on shortwave radio. Yeah.
You know, similar thing. Also, if you watch what's going on in Washington about this similar time, you're getting people coming in who are a new voice in the Republican Party, people like Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay. And they're kind of speaking to something that McVeigh is envisioning, too.
Well, yeah. And again, I think it's very important to draw distinctions here between, you know, rhetoric that and what McVeigh did. You know, Newt Gingrich did not create Tim McVeigh. However, exactly. You know, when you look at the extreme rhetoric that became so prevalent in the 1990s on the right, whether it was Gingrich, you know, talking about evil, talking about the Holocaust, talking about, you know, he was standing between the United States and the return of Auschwitz. When you talk about Rush Limbaugh accusing the Clintons of murder, when it comes to Vince Foster, their former aide, and other people, that kind of extreme rhetoric, when you had someone like McVeigh, was part of his motivation for violence. It was a different Republican Party than the 1980s and the 1970s.
So when you look at all of this, the Branch Davidian siege, which starts with federal agents, DEA agents, Randy Weaver, which I think involves the FBI, he's kind of seeing this as, this is what I thought was going to happen. They're doing this now.
Well, that's right. And you know, again, if I can, I mean, obviously I want everyone to read and buy my book, Homegrown. I'd like to talk about another book for a second, which won the Pulitzer Prize this year, a book by a historian named Jefferson Cowie called Freedom's Dominion, about a county in Alabama, happens to be the home county of George Wallace. And what Professor Cowie does in that book is he traces the hostility to the federal government in this one county, starting all the way before the Civil War, and showing how the extremism there, much of it motivated by the issue of race and the hatred of Black people, is manifest in hatred of the federal government. And what's so interesting about that book, for me in particular, having, you know, who, as I was writing about the Oklahoma City bombing, is you see that this hostility to the federal government as an invasive outside force, especially on the issue of guns, is something that has been motivating right-wing anger in this country, you know, not for years, but for decades. And the story of the Oklahoma City bombing is not at all the beginning of that. It is just one point along the way. And of course, as I write in the book, so was January 6th, part of that same story.
The enormous explosion at a federal building in Oklahoma City this morning was the work of terrorists. The bomb went off just as hundreds of people had showed up for work, just as children had been dropped off at a daycare center on the second floor.
That is April 19th, 1995. That's the voice of ABC News anchor Peter Jennings. So this is shortly after Timothy McVeigh ignited that bomb at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. 168 people killed, 19 of them children. You know, Jeffrey, McVeigh and Terry Nichols picked that day, you've already mentioned, because it's the second anniversary of the end of the Waco siege. Also, isn't it the anniversary of the beginning of the American Rebellion back in 1775?
Yes, I mean, that was also one of the reasons McVeigh picked April 19th. The Battle of Lexington and Battle of Concord began with the shot heard round the world on Lexington Green. And I think it's important to recognize the enduring interest and indeed obsession with the American Revolution among certain right-wing extremists. And this was something that I certainly didn't know until I started working on Homegrown. You know, McVeigh had memorized the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. Now, many people are familiar with the opening few lines of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, et cetera, et cetera. However, much of the Declaration, much more of it actually, is the list of grievances that the American colonists had against the king in England and the justification for their violent rebellion. And McVeigh saw his actions as akin to those of the American colonists who rebelled against the British. And the prologue to my book is called 1776, because again, this is something I didn't know until I started working on the book, is that the protesters and the rioters on January 6th also analogized their rebellion against Biden's election as akin to that of the American Revolution. You see that in a lot of the rhetoric on January 6th. Congresswoman Boebert of Colorado tweets on the morning, "Today is 1776. Alex Jones, the right-wing broadcaster, gives a whole speech where he analogizes their work to the American Revolution. In the crowd on January 6th, you see the Gadsden flag, which is the famous yellow flag with the snake and different picture of the snake cut up, you know, a symbol of the American Revolution, also of the rebellion on January 6th. So April 19th is not just, as you point out, the anniversary of Waco. It is a way of claiming kinship by McVeigh with the rebels of the American Revolution. I should add that he is, of course, perverting what those people stood for, but of course, that wasn't his view of it.
In reading the Declaration of Independence, he talks about usurpations. That's a word that he loves to use, that he loves to repeat. And he believes that the government is overstepping itself. And he's pointing to these different events that you're talking about in the book as clear examples of that.
But so often when he's talking about the usurpations, he's talking about the issue of guns and the threat of guns. And just to go back to the most important document in motivating McVeigh, it was this really evil and dystopian novel called The Turner Diaries, which he read as a teenager and read over and over again. He sold it at gun shows. He pressed it on all his friends. And the story of The Turner Diaries is an imagined contemporary story of how the federal government, again, the evil federal government, had been taken over by a sinister cabal of blacks and Jews. It's a horribly racist and anti-Semitic book. And Earl Turner, who is the hero and the narrator of the novel, fills a truck. And the first thing that this evil cabal of blacks and Jews do is they pass a law called the Cohen Act.
Cohen Act.
Very, very subtle, right? which calls for the confiscation of all privately owned firearms. That's the motivation for Earl Turner's rebellion. And what he does is he fills a truck with an improvised explosives of fertilizer and fuel oil, and parks it next to the FBI building in Washington, kills hundreds of people, and that in turn sets off a national rebellion against the evil federal government. That's why McVeigh did a truck bomb, because he wanted to duplicate what Earl Turner did in the novel, for the same reason, that the evil federal government was taking away people's guns.
After the bombing, the governor of Oklahoma called, and they still didn't know who did it, but he called the people who did this animals. But when he was captured, Timothy McVeigh was proud of what he did.
That's right. And Homegrown is both, you know, a political story about the past and future, but it's also a true crime story. It is the story of why McVeigh did this and how he did it. And the story of how he did it is, you know, remarkable and evidence of, you know, McVeigh's kind of evil genius. I mean, this was an enormously complex undertaking to assemble these ingredients, to, you know, not to get caught. To assemble them in Kansas, deliver them to the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, and then of course it's the story of how it was investigated and prosecuted and also defended. You know, one of the main figures in my book is Stephen Jones, who was McVeigh's lead defense lawyer, and you know, I think Stephen Jones, you know, made some mistakes, didn't do some of the right things. But he had a hell of a difficult problem, you have to acknowledge, because his client was proudly guilty of the and thus not that easy to defend in a trial. So the issue of how to defend McVeigh when in part he wanted to take credit for the bombing is one of the challenges and one of the main stories in Homegrown.
You know, Terry Nichols is going to be apprehended. He's going to be tried, convicted, too. You call him almost as evil as McVeigh, but not nearly as skillful. McVeigh really is the driving force.
Yes. I don't think there's any doubt that if Terry Nichols had been left to his own devices, this bombing would never happen. He didn't have the energy or frankly the intelligence to pull it off. That does not mean he was innocent at all. He was part of the conspiracy. You know, 2 days before the bombing, he and McVeigh mixed the bomb in a little state park in Junction City, Kansas. I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing, but you know, he was not as involved, and he was not present at the bombing. On the day of the bombing, he was home in Kansas. What's interesting about Nichols' story is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, he's from rural Michigan, and his family were struggling family farmers, and his origin story is very much about the decline of agricultural life in America, just as McVeigh's story is about the decline of industrial life in America. So in that way, they are strangely parallel. Nichols was older, considerably older than McVeigh, much more of a professional loser than McVeigh was. You know, he had failed at many jobs. He had tried to be in real estate. He had tried to repair slot machines in Las Vegas. They met in the Army, which was also a significant influence on both of them. McVeigh enlisted, you know, at the customary time, right out of high school. Terry Nichols enlisted at age 33, which was very unusual to be that old. And in fact, flunked out of the Army effectively in fairly short order, but their meeting in the Army is what started the whole conspiracy.
You know, one of the amazing things in the book is, I remember when this first happened, there were all kinds of talks from people, discussion about a wider conspiracy, people on the right and the left saying that it wasn't just these two. In the book, you make pretty clear that no, these are the fellows right here.
Right. I mean, and there has been this interesting attempt on both the left and the right to try to fit the facts of the story into a broader political agenda. On the right, that has often manifested itself as an attempt to show that McVeigh and Nichols were part of a foreign conspiracy. That, I mean, even there was a congressman in from California named Dana Rohrabacher who wrote a whole report claiming that McVeigh and Nichols were somehow affiliated with Osama bin Laden. Completely ridiculous, in my view. But again, an attempt to on the right to show that, well, terrorism is always a foreign problem. It's not a right-wing problem. On the left, there has been an attempt to show that McVeigh and Nichols were actually part of a broader right-wing conspiracy, that they worked perhaps with this weird compound in Oklahoma called Elohim City, that the people on the left were trying to show that there were lots of people on the right involved in this conspiracy. Also untrue, as the evidence that I show in Homegrown. But the person who saw this most clearly of all was Bill Clinton. And this to me was one of the most interesting things I learned in writing Homegrown. You know, on the day of the bombing, there was a lot of speculation, including in the news media, that this was the work of foreign terrorists, because it had only been 2 years since the first World Trade Center bombing in New York, which was the work of foreign terrorists. And people were speculating that this was the work of foreign terrorists. Now, Bill Clinton, on April 19th, 1995, he gave a very cautious open public statement, talking about his sympathy for the victims and his determination to catch whoever did this. But in the course of my reporting the book, I learned that back in the Oval Office, when he was talking with his staffers, they said to him, well, a lot of people think this is foreign. And Clinton says, no, this wasn't foreign. This was the militias. And he was right. So when I interviewed him for the book, I said, well, how did you know? And he said, because I knew them in Arkansas. He had been governor of Arkansas for 12 years, and he told me chapter and verse about all the encounters he had had with violent right-wing extremism as the governor of Arkansas, which after all is right next to Oklahoma. And I was astonished by this. I didn't realize how much violence there had been. And Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, had this photographic memory, which I then, confirmed by my independent reporting about all this right-wing violence that he had seen. And I just thought that was an interesting insight into Clinton's experience as president, and also his prescience about what's really gone on in this country.
If you go back in history, we're going back to 1948. This is the running for presidency. Harry Truman is going to be the Democrats' nominee. But the Southern Democrats are upset with the fact that, the fact that he is pushing for some changes in terms of civil rights. And they break away and form their own party with Strom Thurmond, who is a segregationist. This is Strom Thurmond, 1948, and this is how he describes why they're so concerned.
It simply means that it's another effort on the part of the president to dominate the country by force and to put into effect these uncalled for and these damnable proposals he has recommended under the guise of so-called civil rights. And I tell you, the American people from one side or the other had better wake up and oppose such a program. And if they don't, the next thing will be a totalitarian state in the United States.
That very apt and revealing clip from Strom Thurmond in 1948 is exactly what Jefferson Cowie was talking about in his book, Freedom's Dominion, about the enduring hostility to the federal government of right-wing extremists in this country, and how much that has been a theme for people of those views long before the Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, what Strom Thurmond was saying there, and remember, so much of the civil rights movement was about the federal government attempting to bring voting rights, to end segregation in the South. And that's what Thurmond was complaining about. I mean, this idea that the federal government was imposing its will on the states. And, of course, the party that Strom Thurmond created to run for president in 1948 was called the States' Rights Party, which was meant to be states' rights as opposed to the unfair imposition of federal power. And that's exactly, in a different way, in a different era, what McVeigh was concerned about with particularly the effort to limit the possession of assault weapons, you know, that the federal government was going to take people's guns away. That was the fear that McVeigh had, just as Strom Thurmond had the fear that the federal government was going to take away the state's rights to ability to segregate schools, prevent Black people from voting, and all the issues that were at the center of the civil rights movement.
So are there elements of that in the January 6th group that shows up?
Well, absolutely, because if you look at what they were concerned about, guns is central. I don't think people recognize how much obviously they wanted Trump to be president and not Biden to be president. But the reason they wanted Trump to be president was because they feared that Biden and the Democratic Party were going to take away people's guns.
There's also this stream of isolationism going through McVeigh, going through what we saw with January 6th, people who really pushing for this sort of thing. And it goes back as far as you can look at the America Firsters with Charles Lindbergh back in the 30s and 40s, and even later with Patrick Buchanan.
Well, Pat Buchanan is a very important figure here, someone whose views McVeigh endorsed and supported, but whose agenda has been very much more enduring than him as an individual. I mean, if you look at, President Trump's agenda, it's very similar to Pat Buchanan's. You know, one thing that was very meaningful to McVeigh was his service in the first Gulf War. He was, that of course was a very short war, a very successful attempt to get Iraq out of Kuwait, which Iraq had invaded. And McVeigh won a Bronze Star. He was the gunner in a Bradley fighting vehicle. But when he returned to the United States, he tried out for the Special Forces, for the Green Berets, and flunked out of the test after just two of the 21 days. He then became very alienated, not just from the broader political world, but from the foreign policy that led to the invasion of Iraq. He was like, well, what were we doing there? Why did we care? Why did it matter whether Iraq invaded Kuwait? And that isolationist idea is something that, as you point out, has also been a touchstone of part of the American right for decades, as you pointed out. Again, Charles Lindbergh in the America First movement, trying to keep the United States out of World War II. And just to go forward, you see this split within the contemporary Republican Party about the war in Ukraine. Just as George Herbert Walker Bush mobilized an international consensus that Iraq had to be stopped from invading a sovereign country like Kuwait, President Biden, supported by a lot of Republicans like Mitch McConnell, like Tom Cotton, thought that the invasion of Russia, the invasion by Russia of Ukraine, was something that a strong United States had to take a stand against. That's a controversial point within the Republican Party. You know, former President Trump has expressed a lot of ambivalence about, whether the United States should be involved in Ukraine. Governor DeSantis has expressed that. That split within the Republican Party illustrates that enduring strain of isolationism, which McVeigh certainly represented, and again, remains an enduring force, not unlike guns, which is sort of unanimously supported as part of the Republican agenda. The isolationism is still kind of up for grabs, and I think it's one of the issues that we're going to see in the Republican primaries in 2024, how that plays out within the Republican Party.
Yeah, isolationism, these instances in which of racism, they seem to play right into what Donald Trump was saying in terms of 2016. I'm not saying that he started those ideas. What I'm saying is he saw those ideas, and he was able to speak to those ideas and to people like the later McVeighs.
Right. I mean, I always want to be careful in drawing distinctions. I mean, Donald Trump did not support Timothy McVeigh for bombing the Murrah
building. Not at all.
And most people on the right do not support the use of violence to overthrow the government. However, this is a strain of in conservative thought in the United States that is very real. And yes, it is true that Donald Trump does not support Timothy McVeigh, but he has essentially supported the January 6th rioters. You know, he has said he's going to pardon lots of them. I mean, the idea that the federal government and is so evil that you need to take up arms against it, and whether it's, and invade the Capitol, that again is a difference in degree, not a difference in kind, from what we saw in 1995. So the language, the extremism, the belief in the justification for violence, that is something that is definitely a connection between 1995 and 2021.
You know, I really want to overemphasize the fact that you're not saying, and the book does not say, and we're not saying that all Trump people are for violent overthrow. But there is this stream, as you say, that we have seen in some far right thought that consistently pops up and seems to pop up more and more lately.
Right. And you know, I think it's important not to engage in false equivalence. You know, when in the debates, in the first debate, or I don't remember if it was the first one of the debates between Biden and Trump in 2020, the Proud Boys had already become an issue and were already, threatening violence and had engaged in some violence. Biden denounced the Proud Boys and effectively challenged Trump to denounce the Proud Boys. And Trump not only declined to denounce the Proud Boys, who were ultimately very much involved in the violence and have been convicted of very serious crimes in connection with January 6th. Trump said the real threat is Antifa and violence on the left. And one thing the FBI has been very clear about over the past 2 years is that is not true, that Antifa is a very small threat and not a pervasive threat and not a threat of extreme violence in the way that the right has. If you look at the statistics, roughly 75% of the political violence in this country is orchestrated on the right. Roughly half of the rest comes from Islamic violence, and half of that comes from left-wing or Black Lives Matter type violence. The real threat of violence in this country is from the right. And if you look at the mass shootings we've had, they are almost all from the right. As I mentioned earlier, the Walmart in El Paso, the church in South Carolina, the synagogue in Pittsburgh, the grocery store in Buffalo. All of that is right-wing violence, and that threat is greater than left-wing violence, and to pretend otherwise is really false equivalence.
You know, one of the amazing things about the book, one of your most important sources in the book Stephen Jones gave all of his documents in this case, I guess, to the University of Texas. And that must have been a treasure trove in terms of trying to figure out McVeigh's mind.
I mean, John, I've been covering trials and you know, cases for decades. You know, I wrote about O.J. Simpson. I've written about all the Clinton trials, all the Trump investigations. And one thing you never get in reporting on all that stuff is, what was the subject saying to his lawyer? And there's a simple reason for that. It's protected by the attorney-client privilege. It's protected by client confidentiality. But Stephen Jones, for reasons that I think are frankly not justifiable, decided to throw all that to the wind and donated 635 boxes of material, including the records of all of his interviews of McVeigh, all of his communications with McVeigh, all of the discovery that the federal government turned over. That means all the FBI interviews of witnesses. It's all at the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And I, I had reservations as a lawyer about whether we should have done that. But as a journalist, I was in heaven. I mean, because it is, you know, it's not my problem. It's not my attorney-client privilege. I had never had sources as in-depth and rich as these were. And of course, I used them extensively in writing Homegrown. But all of my lawyer friends who've read my book, they're like, are you kidding? He really did this? But hey, you know, that's his problem, not my problem.
You know, a lot of people describe Timothy McVeigh as soulless. As you saw all this material, do you agree with that?
You know, I think that's a pretty good description of him. I mean, I do talk about the influences, you know, whether it was his politics or his upbringing or his relationships with women or his service in the army, you know, all of that is true. But all of those influences were felt on other, you know, that he had that in common with a lot of other people. There is a uniquely evil quality to this person. He was, I having covered a lot of crime, I feel that there are some people who are just bad, and they are going to commit crimes. And soulless, I think, is one of the is a fairly apt description. As you mentioned, one of the things that many people remember about the Oklahoma City bombing is that there was the daycare center on the second floor, and 19 of the 168 people who were killed were children. And McVeigh's lawyers asked him about that. And he said, I didn't know there was a daycare center there. But if I had known there was a daycare center, I would have done it anyway, because lots of children died in Waco as well when that place caught on fire. So the FBI struck first blood. This was a legitimate response on my part. Anyone who could say something like that is evil, in my view, is soulless. And I don't think you can separate that from the larger story of the case.
You know, and you've touched on this a little, the scary thing is they didn't have McVeigh and Nichols, they didn't have social media. And now with social media, and we see, it seems, much more of this desire for political change through violence, at least on the internet and that sort of thing.
And if you look at the political violence that we've seen in the modern era, you know, since the 90s, it's all either directly planned on the internet or heavily influenced by the internet. I mean, the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer, which fortunately was intercepted before it came to fruition, was plotted on Facebook private chats. You know, Dylann Roof, who killed all those people in South Carolina, what was radicalized by what he saw on the internet and posted stuff on the internet. And frankly, I don't know what you can do about that, because, you know, I am a journalist. I am a believer in the First Amendment. I don't want the government scrutinizing everything on the internet. And even if they did, I think the First Amendment allows a lot of extremist speech. But the internet's not going anywhere, and social media is not going anywhere. And so the ability of people to connect and find soulmates and have their views reinforced on the internet is a very scary prospect. And we have seen the results of it in the kind of violence we've been talking about. And I have to believe there's just going to be more of that.
Author and legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin has been with us. He's written in the past about the O.J. Simpson trial, the Clinton impeachment, the Supreme Court, Donald Trump. His new book is Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. Jeffrey, been great talking to you.
Thanks so much, Sean.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Use any podcast app to get the Think Podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.